This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Algerians were committed to two things. One, they wanted the president, who suffered a stroke and has been ailing for 6 years and hasn't given a public speech in 6 years, to not present himself for a fifth mandate of 5 years. And second, they wanted systemic change, and they got commitments from the president for both of those yesterday.
That was William Lawrence, professor of international relations at George Washington University, on the situation in Algeria. Details next. Also, more countries have grounded Boeing's 737 MAX 8 passenger jets after one of the planes crashed near Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, killing 157 people. And the UN says violence between communities in the Western DRC may be considered crimes against humanity. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Algeria's ailing president Abdelaziz Bouteflika announced yesterday that he's dropping his bid for a fifth term in office. After weeks of protests against his candidacy, he also postponed elections that were scheduled for April 8th. The veteran leader said he was responding to what he called a pressing demand from the Algerian people. Demonstrations against Bouteflika's bid for another term have brought tens of thousands of protesters onto the streets for each of the last 3 days. The president, who has been in a wheelchair since a 2013 stroke, just returned from medical treatment in Switzerland. William Lawrence, professor of international relations at George Washington University, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about what prompted the Algerian president to step aside and whether his announcement is genuine or a political maneuver.
Unprecedented protests from Algerians. We've had millions of Algerians in the street in numbers we haven't seen since the end of the war for independence some 60 years ago. And Algerians were committed to two things. One, they wanted the president, who suffered a stroke and has been ailing for 6 years and hasn't given a public speech in 6 years, to not present himself for a fifth mandate of 5 years. And second, they wanted systemic change, and they got commitments from the president for both of those yesterday.
Bouteflika vowed to hand over the duties of presidency to a freely elected successor, but gave no date for new elections. What do you make of that?
Yes, he refashioned commitments he'd made about a week before about a national conference, and many things would flow from this national conference, including the new constitution, a new government, and new elections. But he wasn't specific about any of those. And if you look at the potential timeline for his announcements, it looks like he could be buying up to another 2 years for the regime to solve a succession crisis, which they haven't solved for 6 years. This succession crisis, of course, is what the protesting crowds is forcing the regime to resolve, but they are not going to wait 2 years. So these protests have not reached their conclusion yet.
So what's next in post-Bouteflika in Algeria?
First of all, Bouteflika, by canceling the elections and withdrawing his bid for a fifth term, is simply extending his fourth term. And the joke in Algeria was, instead of a fifth 5-year term, he's announced a fourth 10-year term. But seriously, what's next is the Algerian crowds are likely to continue to protest until Bouteflika announces his resignation, which has not happened, and until a more clear plan is in place for some kind of transitional government. One of the problems here is that the regime doesn't have a proper spokesperson because the president cannot speak. And there's no designated spokesperson that speaks on behalf of the president with any authority. And the crowds themselves don't have a leader. So you have one side communicating by letter read on the newscast at night, and the other side communicating mostly by slogans in the street. So until we have a proper dialogue between the regime and the street, we probably won't have a proper negotiation about Algeria's future.
Would the military establishment in Algeria allow a real transition toward democracy?
Possibly. They did in 1989, and Algeria did have a two-year democratic opening through 1991, at which point free and fair elections were canceled and a military coup occurred to prevent an Islamist party from taking over as the head of a democratically elected government, not unlike Egypt in 2012 and the coup of 2013. So both sides are on guard. We have heard no Islamist slogans from the crowds in Algeria, nor are they are Islamists driving these protests. And on the other side, we hear very little talk about handing power over to any sort of opposition political party on the other side. So again, we're waiting to see what type of political formation is going to represent the protesting crowds. As of now, all we have is crowds in the streets.
That was William Lawrence from George Washington University speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. More countries have grounded Boeing's 737 MAX 8 passenger jets after one of the planes crashed near Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, killing 157 people Sunday. After Ethiopia, China, and Indonesia grounded the planes yesterday, Australia, Singapore, and Britain followed suit today. Workers continue recovering personal items and the remains of those killed when the plane struck the ground and shattered. Both black box flight recorders have been recovered. Officials from the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, and the National Transportation Safety Board arrived today at the crash site, 45 kilometers from Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa. The FAA said it expects Boeing will soon complete improvements to an automated system designed to keep the plane from stalling. The system is suspected of playing a part in a deadly crash in October. That crash near Jakarta, Indonesia, killed 189 people. Thomas Anthony is director of the Aviation Safety and Security Program at the University of Southern California. He said he understands why some countries would ground the aircraft.
If you were a country and you didn't know whether the airlines in your country had received the airworthiness directive, had trained the airworthiness directive, and it was being implemented, that would be a prudent thing to do.
But he warned that it often takes many factors to cause a disastrous accident like the one in Ethiopia. Boeing said it is sending experts to Ethiopia to help in the investigation. It also is updating flying instructions for the plane. The Associated Press reports that it has spoken to a witness who saw smoke coming from the back of the plane and that it turned in the air twice before hitting the ground. Several countries, including much of Europe, have banned the 737 MAX aircraft from their airspace, and many airlines are grounding their 737 MAX 8 airliners. It is estimated that about 40% of the 737 MAX 8s have been grounded. And mourning continues for the 157 victims of the crash. They came from at least 35 countries. The United Nations is especially feeling the loss, with at least 21 of its workers among the dead. Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke about the victims.
I extend my deepest condolences to the families and loved ones of all the victims, to the government of people of Ethiopia, and all these affected by this disaster. We are working closely with government officials on the ground and mobilizing assistance, counseling, and any other needed support during this difficult time.
In Washington, the University of Georgetown mourned the loss of law student Cedric Asayavugwa, who was on his way to Nairobi, Kenya. In a letter to his family, the university wrote that it had lost a dedicated champion of social justice across East Africa and the world. The United Nations says violence between communities in the Western DRC may be considered crimes against humanity. At least 535 people died in violence over 3 days in December, shortly before the country's presidential election. The violence broke out in the area of Yombi between the Banunu and Batende communities. A dispute over the burial of the Banunu customary chief appears to have taken place before the violence. A UN report released today says the Banunu villagers were targeted with weapons, including firearms and gasoline. The number of people killed is likely higher because bodies are believed to have been dumped in the Congo River. The violence displaced 19,000 people and damaged or destroyed nearly 1,000 buildings, including churches, schools, and healthcare centers. The report said provincial officials appear to have failed in their responsibility to protect the population. The independent expert on the enjoyment of human rights by persons with albinism reports how those with this condition have great difficulty getting justice or recompense for physical attacks and other harmful practices against them and their families. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, where the expert's latest report has been under debate at the UN Human Rights Council.
Last year has been a particularly difficult one for persons with albinism in southern Africa. UN expert Ikponwosa Ero says she has received numerous reports of abhorrent attacks against them. From past experience, she says it is likely the number of reported cases does not reflect the true magnitude of the problem. Over the past decade, she says there have been more than 700 cases of attacks in 28 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. She notes these are reported cases. Most, she says, are never brought to light. Worldwide, Ero says persons with albinism suffer from discrimination, stigma, and social exclusion. She says they are subject to physical attacks and harmful practices related to certain beliefs in magic and witchcraft. However, when they seek redress, she says persons with albinism too frequently are denied access to justice.
Overall, in terms of these criminal cases, inordinate delays are common in prosecuting cases of serious charges, such as murder and mutilation. Cases with relatively lesser charges, such as threats and possession of exhumed body parts from grave sites, are, depending on the country in question, either prosecuted relatively quickly or are not taken seriously at all.
Ero says there are many barriers to access to justice, including lack of knowledge by victims on how the justice system works. She says discrimination from members of the legal community and the inability to pay the costs associated with going to court are other impediments. The independent expert says specific measures must be taken to improve access to justice for persons with albinism. She recommends victims and their relatives be given protection to encourage them to come forward with evidence of a crime. She says they also should be rehabilitated. Ero says persons with albinism who are seeking justice should receive legal aid, and laws should be amended to take into account the threats targeting this particular group. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
18 past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. As Uganda-Rwanda tensions continue to soar, it appears Rwanda's President Paul Kagame is trying to work with Kenya and Tanzania to make sure his country maintains access to the ports of Mombasa and Dar es Salaam. He has recently visited Tanzania and this week met with Kenya's president. Eugene Uwimana has report from Kigali.
Dr. Paul Kananura, the president of Mandela Institute, says in international relations, there are no friends forever and no enemies forever. It all depends on a country's interest. Kananura, who is an international relations expert, says Rwandan President Paul Kagame's recent visit to Tanzania and his meeting with Kenya's president are intended to ease and sustain cross-border trade. With Kenya in particular, Kagame's talks this week appear to have stressed the benefits of regional commerce.
The two presidents might have talked about cross trade, which tackles ports. Kenyans, like Rwandans, use the East African Northern Corridor for imports and exports. This means that the issue of trading routes should be an important item on the agenda. But as Kenya is among the founders of the East African community, two leaders might have highlighted how important intra-regional trade is, of course, to show how the interest should come first. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta was in Uganda Monday to address the National Leadership Retreat. He told the assembled business persons, government and military leaders that every challenge the East African countries encounter has to be quickly resolved to help improve regional integration.
Because at the end of the day, Rwanda alone will not make it. Kenya alone will not make it. But together, we have huge and tremendous potential of growing prosperity for our people and for our countries.
Roughly 2 weeks ago, standoff over the Uganda-Rwanda border began. Some Rwandan businessmen say since they are not allowed to travel to Uganda, the goods brought in from Kampala are becoming more expensive. Jean-Paul Vukingoma works in the Kimilonko market. He says most of his merchandise is from Uganda. For example, he used to pay 32,000 for 1 carton of oil, and now it is 35,000. He says milk used to be 11,000, and now it is 15,000. And the price of other commodities like soaps have also gone up. Rwanda is landlocked, so it needs to reach ports in Dar es Salaam and Mombasa through Uganda. The government has accused Uganda of blocking Rwandan vehicles going or coming from Mombasa. But Uganda denies the allegations and says Kigali has closed border crossing points. Since when tensions began to rise nearly 3 years ago, President Paul Kagame of Rwanda and President Yoweri Museveni of Uganda have heard talks, but they have made no progress in improving the relationship. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
The heads of state from South Africa and Zimbabwe co-chaired the third edition of the Bi-National Commission in Zimbabwe's capital today. The commission seeks to strengthen relations between the neighboring countries. Reporter Kudzai Zanawashi has more.
Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa gave an update of what his country has been doing to reform and shock the economy back to health after decades of economic depression.
We have embarked on a concerted reform, restructuring, rebuilding, modernization and industrialization exercise. Tough decisions are being implemented, which are often unpalatable, but must be made all the same. To instill confidence in our economic landscape, we are enforcing fiscal discipline.
Mnangagwa said, creating a welcoming business environment remains high on the agenda, so laws are being aligned with the constitution. He expressed gratitude towards his South African counterpart, who took time to attend the commission despite South African national elections in 2 months. South Africa President Cyril Ramaphosa said they discussed various issues that affected the two nations, including the solidarity call for the suspension of sanctions on Zimbabwe by the US and the European Union.
We've been very clear as South Africa that the sanctions are unfair, they are unjust, and the time has now come for those sanctions to be lifted. We have been calling for those sanctions to be lifted immediately because they impede the growth of the Zimbabwean economy.
Mnangagwa endorsed Ramaphosa's call for sanctions to be lifted, but says Zimbabwe will not bury its head in the sand, but will continue pushing towards reforms. Judging by the state of current affairs in Zimbabwe, many may think Zimbabwe is the beneficiary from the binational talks, but financial expert Brian Matamba explains how South Africa will benefit.
It's an interesting visit, given that also South Africa has also been going through a slowdown in the economy. This year, the economy is projected to grow less than 1%. Zimbabwe happens to be one of their biggest trade partners. in the region, where they export annually close to 30 billion rands worth of goods and services.
He adds that both parties stand to benefit, but such high-level diplomatic meetings are often characterized by a series of agreements which are often not implemented. South Africa and Zimbabwe's relations are intertwined. Zimbabwe's decades of economic failure have pushed many unemployed Zimbabweans to migrate to South Africa in search of greener pastures. Interestingly, Zimbabwe's unproductive state has resulted in high demand for South African products that find their way into Zimbabwe's market. For VOA, this is Kudza Isinawashe from Harare.
A UN investigative body is urging the African Union to quickly establish a court for South Sudan to prosecute perpetrators of heinous crimes and bring justice to victims of sexual violence, torture, and other human rights violations. We have Lisa Schlein again reporting from Geneva, where the Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan has submitted its report to the UN Human Rights Council.
The Commission says many of the incidents documented in its report could amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. The three-member panel has identified 23 individuals it says are responsible for serious crimes under international law. The list will be handed over to the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights for future prosecutions. The report, which is based on a fact-finding mission to South Sudan, details multiple incidents of rapes and gang rapes at the hands of both government and opposition forces. It documents countless incidents of sexual slavery, abductions, forced marriage and pregnancy, mutilation of sexual organs, as well as killings. Commission Chair Yasmin Suka says 25% of all reported cases of conflict-related sexual violence involve children, some as young as seven.
These are not random incidents of sexual violence, but a systematic, widespread pattern and characteristic of the conflict in South Sudan, where rape and sexual violence are used as a tactic of warfare against women and girls by all the warring parties to sow terror and fear amongst the civilian population.
Suka says no one is safe, not young boys, the elderly, or the disabled. She says sexual violence is deliberately used to break the societal norms that have held the people of South Sudan together. The report says arbitrary detention, torture, and enforced disappearances have also increased. It finds people are held in prison under horrific conditions. It says they are tortured and treated in the cruelest, most inhumane manner, and that many have died after subsisting on starvation diets. The commission calls on South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar to ensure those responsible for heinous crimes are prosecuted. South Sudan's civil war was triggered by a power struggle between Kiir and Machar, who was vice president at the time and will assume the post again in a planned transitional government. Justice Minister Paulino Wanawila Onango said human rights in the country were improving and fighting had largely subsided since a peace agreement was signed in September. He downplayed the magnitude of violations presented by the commissioners. For example, he noted a government investigation found the alleged gang rapes of 125 women in Bentiu last November to be exaggerated and said only 16 rapes had occurred. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned to the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Tomas Blondet, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an exclusive interview with the Vice President of Malawi, Saulos Chilema. The Malayan politician and VOA's Shaka Sali discuss democracy and the upcoming elections. An in-depth look at Malawi's future on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.